Join us as we cover many an insane movie and numerous cult TV phenomenons. Are you ready to get jacked up? Are you with us? Then listen on.
Welcome back once again. Your host Cam Sully is here, and here I am interviewing another talent who's been on here multiple times, but it's time for his close-up. It's Braden D. White. How are you, sir?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
I'm fine. So we are here to again cover your martial arts and filmography. So tell us a little about how you decided you wanted to blend action movies that you grew up loving with your personal passions.
I think in order to do that, let me start by describing where my love of martial arts and film came from, because it all stems from the same thing. When I was growing up, I have two brothers. I have an older brother who is 2 years older than me, and I have a younger brother who is 5 years younger than me. So when I was growing up, my older brother was into Power Rangers, and by watching him watch Power Rangers, I got into Power Rangers. And that's where it started, just me loving to watch Power Rangers. And then before I even knew what action movies really were, I would just see like my dad or sometimes my grandma would be watching Walker, Texas Ranger. And before I even really knew what martial arts were as a whole, I would just see the way they would fight on like Walker, Texas Ranger or something and be like, wow, they're fighting like the Power Rangers. And then I think I was like 7 whenever I finally learned the term martial arts and karate, and it grew from there. Like it started from me wanting to be a Power Ranger, and then I was 10 years old when my dad signed me up for my first karate lessons with a guy that he worked with, and at the time he was a 7th degree black belt. And probably should explain that my parents split up when I was very young. So I would live with my mom during the school year and visit my dad in the summer, and no need to feel sorry for me and anything. I don't really have any memory of my mom and dad being together, but you know, I'm no worse for wear. I had a great life. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh. All right.
And so I would come visit my dad, and he made a deal with me. He's like, hey, mom tells me you make good grades, then I'll sign you up for karate class. So I made good grades. He signed me up for karate class. And I was 10 years old. But I specifically remember a point, and I was like 8 years old. I was watching this one movie, and there was kids like my age, and they were doing karate, and they were beating up adults. I don't remember the movie.
Green Ninjas?
But they were, actually, I think it was one of those, actually.
Nice.
But yeah, they were beating adults, and I was like, you know what? Maybe this is something I can do. And I remember my dad calling me downstairs at his house, and we watched it together. And I remember just offhandedly saying, you know what? I think I could do this. And I think I'll start probably age 10 or 11. But, you know, I had no idea that how right I really was, because at 10 years old is when I started taking karate. And then, you know, as I got older, you know, I learned who Jackie Chan and Jet Li and Bruce Lee and all these different people were. And my love just grew from there, really.
Very neat. And when did it just click that, you know, these guys were icons? They were kind of your heroes, and you wanted to kind of be some kind of hero in some capacity.
I don't really have a moment where it clicked, where I had an epiphany and said, man, these are icons. Like, at this point, right. Yeah, like I didn't, at that time in my martial arts journey per se, I had no idea the cultural significance of the movies they were making. You know what I mean? To me, they were just making some kick-ass action movies. But I do remember, like I said, don't remember the exact moment, but I do remember having the conversation with myself that I want to do these types of movies, because I was doing karate and I was like, these guys are getting paid real money to do karate on TV. I want to be one of those guys.
Very cool. And so a little backtrace, what inspired you other than, again, just spiritually, just loving the martial arts and just seeing how badass it can be? Was it also just saying, you know, health and fitness?
Honestly, it, like, I would like to say that I have some sort of spectacular story about, you know, I saw how much discipline it gave me. I wish I had some sort of story like that. But honestly, it just, on a much, much simpler level, I just enjoyed doing it. It was something that I found fun. You know how, like, you have people who go to the park and they like playing baseball or basketball? Martial arts was it for me. I just found it fun. To me, whenever I'd go to karate class, it was like, it would be the equivalent of going to the park every weekend for a pickup game.
For sure. And
so, like I said, I wish I had some sort of story. Be like, I saw how much discipline it gave me. I saw the values that it brought to my life. No, I had fun with it.
Oh, good. Okay. Who was your mentor?
Like, personal mentor?
Yes.
Yeah.
What trained you?
Well, I've had a few. I will say that my first instructor, who is also now, again, my current instructor, his name is Master Mark Haley. When I first started training under him, he was a 7th degree black belt, and he is now currently an 8th degree black belt. And he is actually in the United States Martial Arts Hall of Fame. I forget what year, somewhere in the 2003 to 2006 range. But he is in the United States Martial Arts Hall of Fame as Shotokan Instructor of the Year. And like I said, he worked with my dad. And, you know, he's like 5'4". He's old and decrepit now, but he still mess you up. But he was the one who set the bar for me. Like, I've been in and out of karate classes. Well, let me explain this a little bit better. I trained with him for a summer, and then when I turned 13, I decided to start living with my dad, and I trained with him throughout that school year. Then he moved because he had a promotion with work. And so ever since then, I've been in and out of dojos. I did boxing for a little bit. I took about a 3-year hiatus to do school sports, and then I picked it back up right before my senior year of high school. But I never fully quit. You know, I was still practicing the stuff that I did know. And so then I found new classes, and I altogether now probably been in and out of about 10 or 12 different styles. But he was the one who set the bar. Like, if I went into this class and I felt like, and it reminded me of a class that he would teach, then I knew that was going to be a good class. But some other personal mentors that I have would be, let's see, an instructor who put a lot of time and effort into me. He doesn't teach anymore, though. His name is Jim Fortner. I learned a lot from him, both good and bad. But I would say the good memories far outweigh the bad. But I trained under him. He was probably the longest instructor I had. I trained with him on and off for about 7 years. And so I learned a lot from him. And then a couple other of my personal mentors. One is Steve Rizak Jr. and Sr. They're a father-son team. They teach class out of a garage in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And I trained with them for about 2 years. And probably they call themselves a meat and potatoes karate school because they don't do a lot of the fancy stuff. They don't do like forms or anything like that. They just basically what it is. They call it freestyle karate, but essentially at its core, it's combat kickboxing. And I love it. They do a really good job over there. And another one, which is a little bit more personal to me now, is my good friend, Master Louis Cruz, who recently just passed away due to COVID-19. He was also slated to be in my next movie, but unfortunately he passed away before we could shoot anything. So we are now making the film in his memory, but he was also like a big brother to me, and he's a man that will be missed greatly, not just by me, but all of his students. And of course his family, his fiance and his two sons as well.
Sure. And I saw your tribute to him, and he just seemed like just, again, everyone just resonated with him.
Oh, yeah, in the town that he lived in, he was borderline legendary. Everyone knew who he was in that town.
For sure, for sure. And all together, what skill would you say you're most experienced in? Obviously, you're experienced in all of them, but what's your go-to style for martial arts?
My go-to style, I consider Shotokan karate to be my base, because one, that's the style that I started in, and two, that's where a lot of my foundation comes from. Like I said, I've dabbled in boxing and kickboxing and taekwondo and stuff like this, but Shotokan karate is what I've always considered myself to be a part of, mainly due to the fact that that's where I started. And I never really abandoned those roots. You know what I mean? Everything. Let me word this a little bit better. Everything that I've learned since up to this point, everything that I've learned since has been in addition to my Shotokan. It hasn't taken its place or anything like that. So I would consider Shotokan karate to be what I call my base style.
Okay. Very neat, very neat. And when you started integrating in boxing, was that around the same time that you were kind of noticing that mixed martial arts was kind of rising in popularity a bit?
Actually, I would even consider, even still to this day, I'm not the biggest fan of mixed martial arts. Like, I enjoy watching it from time to time, but I'm not one that catches all the UFC fights on pay-per-view or anything like that. Right. Really, what it just came down to was options. Like I said, my karate teacher moved when I was 13, so I didn't have a school. But, turn of events, my science teacher in eighth grade is a former pro boxer. He has stats on the internet and everything. His name is Barry Audia, and he was known as the Pennington Pounder. Because his hometown, his hometown here in Virginia is Pennington Gap. So he was known as the Pennington Pounder. And he told me, he was like, hey, I got some MMA guys that work out at my gym. And, you know, I have a couple bags that if you want to throw some kicks, you can throw some kicks. And so basically it was basically out of not wanting to stop training, but not really having any other options to go. So I started taking boxing, and I worked out with these MMA guys towards the end of class, and we worked on some kicks. And like I said, the MMA really didn't have an effect on my decision to join the boxing gym, and the fact that I didn't want to learn MMA, but it was the fact that there were MMA guys that trained there, and I wanted somebody there to help me so I could keep training my kicks and my karate and stuff like that.
Okay, very cool. And how would you describe your various moves that you're able to demonstrate?
How would I describe them? I've been told that someone my size should not be able to move the way that I can. And it's because over the last 7 years, I would say, I've put on roughly 100 pounds. But I've been training almost consistently for that entire time. So I never really lost any of my ability. It's just some of it became harder to do. Because of my size, now I have more weight. Like if I'm throwing a spinny kick, I have to throw it a little bit harder. I can still do it. It just takes more effort. So I would say what I used to jokingly refer to as I would say, especially when I was like in my late teens and early 20s, I would say that I'm bimble, which is big and nimble. So I would say I'm bimble.
Nice.
But basically, yeah, I've just been told that someone my size should not be able to move the way that I can. And it goes both ways. People are almost mad that I can move the way that I can, and I have people that are really, really impressed.
Okay, very neat. So altogether, would you also say that, you know, you're getting great feedback like that, and that just, you're just in an overall positive environment growing up, in addition to everyone encouraging you to, you know, go for this?
Yeah. Like I would totally say that I grew up in a positive environment. Like I said, you know, just because my parents split up when I was around 2 years old, that doesn't mean that, you know, I was lucky enough to have parents who didn't use the kids as bargaining tools. You know what I mean? They tried their best to work everything out in the best interest of me and my brother. So I can honestly say that I grew up in, I'm not going to say that everything was happy, because, you know, every family has their issues and stuff. I'm not going to say that I was, you know, a perfect kid, because I got in trouble, but I will honestly say that I grew up in a positive and constructive environment. I can honestly say that.
Okay, that's great that you can attest to that. And altogether, so when came the time for when you decided, hey, you know, okay, I've had a solid upbringing. I've had, you know, just always practicing my skill set and everything. When did you finally decide, hey, I want to actually kind of incorporate this into some kind of movie, whether it's, you know, a low budget, you know, kickboxing film or an actual mainstream movie?
I would say the time when I really decided that I wanted to take doing movies seriously, I will honestly say the time that I made up my mind that I wanted to do it, I had no legitimate means of trying to make it happen. I remember being 13 years old, and I had a computer class, and after I would get done with my assignments, I would start writing scripts. And this one script that I had in my mind, like, I found it not long ago, like about a year ago. I refound it on one of my old hard drives, and I almost cried. It was so bad. But in my 13-year-old me's mind, this was going to be the movie that put me into stardom. I was going to have Jet Li play my kung fu teacher. And then, like I said, I found it about a year ago on an old hard drive, and like it physically hurt to read. It was so bad. But that was when I was 13. And then I would say I was about 18 when there was actually one specific movie that I was watching that made me realize, and you know, it's something that's rang true for a while. I just never really put two and two together until after watching this movie. And I'll say it like this. When you have a big budget movie, I think a perfect example, two perfect examples of this are the Bourne franchise and the Dark Knight trilogy. When you have franchises that are that big, you have enough money to find an actor who plays the character that you need, and they also have enough money to hire somebody to train these two actors to be able to at least look like they know what they're doing. Mm-hmm. If anything, they train them in the choreography. They don't train them in the art itself, but they run through the choreography so much that it looks like they're proficient.
Right.
And they have enough time to finesse it and make it look good, but they also have enough time to set up like six cameras and they'll cut it together in the editing room and you really don't know what's going on.
Right.
With lower budget movies, you don't have that kind of time or luxury. So you have to find somebody who can portray the character that you're looking for, but also has the skill set that you're looking for.
Totally.
And the movie that I was watching, it's gone by like three different titles. I found like three different titles of it. When I first watched it, it was called American Brawler. And then I think on like Amazon or Tubi TV, I saw it as Barrio Brawler.
Yeah. It was like 2011, 2013.
So. Yeah, 2013. And then I saw it called American Pit Fighter. But that was the movie because I'm a big fan of watching the behind-the-scenes featurettes. And I remember them saying that the reason they were able to get a movie this quality done was because basically everyone knew each other already. They were all in the martial arts universe together. And they had 14 days to shoot the entire movie. And basically what they did was everyone was working out together anyway. So they just got everybody together and they shot the fight scenes within the first like 3 days. All the fight scenes of the movie were done in like the first 3 days. And the rest was ironing out the drama and reshoots. But they had 14 days to shoot that entire movie.
14 days, man.
And so that's at the point whenever I realized, you know what? And that's when I really started thinking back and I was like, you know what? Some of these lower budget movies actually are some of my favorite movies because I started thinking back to Art of War 2 with Wesley Snipes and Undisputed 3 and Never Back Down 2 and those kind of movies that are, you know, by Hollywood standards are considered low budget.
Right. Less than $2 million.
Yeah. And that's when I started thinking, you know what? This is something that's doable. So that's when I started taking my screenwriting a little bit more seriously. And of course, I always took my martial arts seriously. And so I figured, well, at this kind of level, acting is really not that much of a factor then, is it? So I kind of delayed the acting a little bit. And I didn't really start taking acting seriously. Let's go about halfway in between watching Barrio Fighter and when I started acting. Around that time is whenever the whole Iron Fist thing happened, which a little bit of a plug for both of us here. If you haven't heard about the Iron Fist thing, we have a whole episode about it. And it's a really interesting story because nothing about it is conventional in the acting sense, but it's a fun story and it was a fun video. You can find it on my YouTube channel. That's when the Iron Fist video happened. And I will say that before the Iron Fist video happened, I was working on a script that I had had the idea of for, let's see, at that point, probably about 5 years, I'd had the idea for this. And basically what triggered me wanting to write that particular version was I had a dream. And I had met a friend, because I'd also recently just started YouTube at this point. And I had met a friend through YouTube who was also doing martial arts videos, and we started talking on Facebook and Snapchat and stuff like that. And I told her about this dream that I had about how we was at a hotel and it got overrun by terrorists. And we basically started doing karate on everybody and kicked butt and took names. And that was the end of it, because she was also a black belt in Taekwondo and karate. So she was the one who inspired me to actually start my YouTube channel. And so I told her about that, and she was like, man, that sounds like it'd be a really cool movie. And I was like, well, if you wanted to try and do a movie, I've had this other idea for a while. And she was like, man, that sounds cool. You should write it out. And so I started writing it, and I wrote it for me, her, and my younger brother at the time, who was in my karate class. And we were all three going to be in it. And again, this is before I had any kind of resources whatsoever. I just wrote it, and I was like, yeah, we're going to be in it. And that was it. Had no idea how I was going to make it happen, but I was going to make it happen. And so then about a year later is when the Iron Fist video happened. And then after tons and tons of rewrites on that one movie, and I had one producer that was interested, but they said that I was kind of glorifying myself too much with the fight scenes. We were making ourselves seem too invincible to be believable.
Hmm.
And also they had an issue with the fact that I was writing it for myself and two friends. And they were like, you're nobodies. I'm not going to put money into this. And I was like, well, the key to this movie is, and it's something I did on purpose, was even though none of us had acting experience, I wrote the characters as us, just with different names. So I didn't think it would be that hard for us to pull them off. But no one was trying to hear that. So then I took an online screenwriting course, and I found out that one of the issues I was making was I was writing the movie in relation to what I knew I could get access to. And in screenwriting, that's a no-no. You just let your imagination flow, and then you make the cuts according to what you can afford then. So after I took that screenwriting course, I essentially shelved that first script that I was working on. And then I started writing another one, and I can't explain where it came from. I have no idea the origin. I would like to say that I had a passion for this subject matter beforehand, but I really didn't. All I knew was it was a subject that sold well in action movies, and that's why I wanted to write it. But that was the origin of Skin Circuit, and it just boiled down to me watching a movie and being like, it was a combination of me wanting to do a movie about human trafficking, and I was watching another movie where the main character was a private investigator, and I liked how he portrayed him, and I was like, and I want to do a movie where I play a private investigator.
Gotcha.
And and keep in mind, and I had done a few acting auditions before, but this was also before I started taking acting classes. And I was just getting fed up because no one was, you know, I felt like I could deliver, but no one else. It was either because I didn't have acting classes, or I was starting to put on weight at this point. So that's when people were like, no, you're too heavy, and all this other kind of stuff. So I was like, well, F this. If no one's going to give me a shot, then I'm going to give me a shot, and I'm going to write this movie, and I'm going to star in it. And so I actually started writing Skin Circuit in my cubicle at my office job that I had at the time. I would like to say that I just had a big brainstorm in like my office or whatever, my workstation at home. But no, I was basically, I was working at a call center at the time, and I had my own cubicle. And I was in between calls, and I just started writing. I didn't have any plan. All I knew was, here's the main character. This is how everything's getting started. And eventually I wanted to end up here.
Right.
So I knew who the characters were. I knew the basic storyline. And I knew how I wanted it to end. Everything else I just kind of let happen as it happened. And all together... to finish my first draft between, you know, all together, because every time I get writer's block and I not touch it for a week or so until I watch a movie and something, you know, just clicks in my head. But all together, it took me about 4 months to finish writing Skin Circuit. And I sat on it for about a year and a half. Because I knew I didn't just want to just hurry up, rush to get it put out and made. Because I knew that it was going to be something special. And then, let's see, I finished writing it in about, I would say, March or April of 2018. And I just sat on it for, like I said, about a year and a half. And then when I moved back to Oklahoma in the beginning of 2019, that's when I got signed with my acting agency that I'm with, Linda Lehman. And they offered they do the course twice a year, or at least they did before COVID. They did the course twice a year, and it was essentially, it was an acting class. Like, it taught you how to act, but its main purpose was to help you envision your scene when you're prepping for an audition. But with teaching you how to immerse yourself in a scene on paper, it taught you how to act, if you know what I mean.
That's cool.
And so I did that course 3 times. And it was in between my first and second time that I had gotten an offer to go down and help on a movie about 3 hours away in your neck of the woods in Denton, Texas.
Sweet.
And I had, I worked as an extra on this short film, and I was down there for 2 days. And the first day I worked as an extra. And then the second day they let me help out behind the scenes as a PA. And then I kept in contact with the director of that film. And she was actually the one who suggested, and it started out, we were going to film a short version of Skin Circuit, and we were going to submit it for a contest that was in Louisiana. Mm-hmm. And so we had made plans that we were going to go location scouting down in Shreveport, Louisiana, but our schedules could never align, and eventually that just kind of fell through. But then she was like, well, I still want to help you make it. And so we started talking about it, and I was like, well, I don't even have a script for the short version. And there's not really any scenes that I could pull from the feature that would really make sense as a short. And so basically what she suggested to me was to take some of the story points from the feature and turn it into a short. So that's what I did. And then a few things happened, schedules couldn't work out and stuff like that, to where she wasn't going to be able to help me. But I had already had these days off for work. So that's when I reached out to my friends over at Headhammer Studio, which I had previously collaborated on a Mortal Kombat spoof called Dragon Combat, that should be coming out later this year. And they also helped me with my little fight scene, The Drive, on my YouTube channel. And so I had reached out to them, and I was like, hey, I have this short that I was supposed to do during these days. I still have my days off, and I don't just want to waste them away. You know, I set them for this purpose. I want to try and do something with this purpose. And they were like, yeah, we can make it work. So that was in probably the beginning of January, and we filmed it the first week of March. So now it was crunch time, and this was my first time. I didn't essentially know what I was doing, but this was my first time being a producer of sorts. I didn't know that's exactly what I was doing, but looking back on it, I was doing the job of a producer. I was getting the locations.
This kind of opened up your mind also, just realizing it's like there's so many job titles, but half the time no one really knows what they mean.
Exactly. And that's essentially what I was doing. Is, you know, I had to find my cast. I had to find my locations. I had to coordinate schedules. And, of course, any organized Hollywood producer would have all this stuff done on paper. No, I'm just trying to be like, okay, I would message this person. Hey, what day are you free? I'm free this day. I would go message this person. Okay, this person's free on this day, so we can do this scene then. Any organized person would have this written down on paper. Mine was just going back and forth between about 4 group chats.
Nice. Yeah, exhausting, but hey, what we got to do?
And that led to some tension. I'm not going to lie. There was a couple, not going to say arguments, but there was a couple quarrels about scheduling and stuff like that. And which really made the first day, well, I'm not even going to say the first day, it made about the first hour of filming a little bit edgy for me. Like, I felt like I was walking on glass a little bit. Mm-hmm. But once we got into it and it was really fun, you know, everyone kind of loosened up and we had fun with it. We shot majority of it in 3 days and then we filmed the next little bit the next week. So, I mean, it was a fun thing. And now it's still not the highest viewed on my channel, but I will say it's been the most well received on my channel is my short film Skin Circuit.
This allow you to kind of just see how, hey, you know, you're in reception mode where it's like, okay, here's what I want. Here's what I'm getting. How do I get to the next wave of where I get what I want, you know, for in a favorable outcome, you know?
Yeah, but also during this time, while I'm trying to get Skin Circuit off the ground, even before, you know, I was continuously, you know, writing other scripts as well. So I was constantly evolving my ideas and wanting to do more. I knew Skin Circuit wasn't going to be the end-all be-all, but I knew that if I had an idea as good as Skin Circuit, I had other ideas that were just as good that just needed to come out. And I actually have another idea that I remember coming up with even before I came up with Skin Circuit. It just kind of forgot about it. You know what I mean? But
okay, so was that the back of your mind where you were just?
Yeah, it was in the back of my mind. I came up with it and I thought it was a cool idea. And I remember trying to write it out a few times, but I never could find. I kept notebooks everywhere, and I never could find the right notebook that had everything written out for when I actually wanted to start writing it. And then after I finished writing Skin Circuit, I was like, man, that was kind of fun. I want to write another one now. And, you know, because as much stress as Skin Circuit caused me with writing it and getting writer's block and all that, I had a tremendous amount of fun writing it. And so after that, I started writing this other one. And I was like, well, because I still remember the base idea. I was like, this is what I want, but I didn't really know what to call it. And so for a while, I would say for about the first 20 or so pages, it didn't have a title. Just because I couldn't think of what to call it. And, you know, after Skin Circuit, I brought it up to some people and they wanted to go ahead and do it. We were having a good time doing it. There were some creative issues and they took it. And I have no problems with that. They're doing a great job with it. but I also took the same base idea and mixed it with my idea that I had for a sequel, and that is eventually what led us to Double Cross. And Double Cross is the new film that I'm getting ready to start filming. They're filming some scenes without me the week of May 21st because I'm starting a new job and I won't be able to make it out there, but there's a ton of scenes that I'm not in. So they're going to go ahead and get those knocked out. And then later on in the year when I'm able to get some time, then I'm going to go down there and we're going to finish up the movie.
Nice. And, you know, it's all copyright, everything. So, you know,
everything's good on, I will say this, without mentioning any names or movie titles or anything like that, I can 100% say, yes, I'm disappointed that I'm not a part of that other movie anymore, just for the simple fact that I created it. And I will always have a spot in my heart for it. But I can, with 100% certainty and 100% honesty, and say I 100% support the vision. And I hope that it does extremely well for everybody.
Sure.
And like I said, because I haven't had a chance to talk to the other party for us to clear the air. At this point, as of this recording of this episode, I haven't had a chance to talk to the other party to clear the air. But yes, I'm upset that I'm not a part of it just for the simple fact that I wanted to be a part of it. But beyond that, I hope it does wonders for everyone, and I hope everyone is happy with the outcome.
Best way to put it. So, seeing other indie action stars like Scott Atkins and Gary Daniels still kicking, who are some people in the indie action industry you think you would love to, if opportunity permitted, collaborate
with? Number one on the list is Scott Adkins. I've been looking up to Scott Adkins since 2009. And I remember I was in my computer class and I was, I just finished all my work and I was just searching the internet. And that's when his movie Ninja was about to come out and they had the trailer out for it. So I was like, oh, I'll check this out. And, you know, Scott Adkins is not a small dude. He's ripped. And so based on seeing him, I was like, oh, this dude looks like an MMA fighter. They taught him a couple cool flashy moves, and they're going to call him a ninja. This is about to be a joke. And then, because I was actually curious to see who he fought for, like UFC, Strikeforce, or whatever. So I Googled for like 2 days to find his name. And then when I found his name, I found one of his old showreels from like the early thousands. I was like, oh, he's like the real deal. Like, he's not an MMA fighter. Like, he can really move like this. I was like, oh, okay, we on to something. And then the movie Ninja came out. And I hope my dad never hears this because I'm about to tell him myself. But I was actually grounded from all my movies at this point. But I went to go visit Who did I go visit? It was actually my brother's girlfriend. We had like a big old get together or something. I was over at my brother's girlfriend's house, and her older brother had actually bootlegged it on the DVD, and he let me borrow the DVD, and that's the first time I saw Ninja. And Scott Adkins was like top tier ever since then. And ever since then, I have not missed a movie that he's put out. And then on top of that, there's some other people I would love to work with, in the indie world anyway. I would love to work with Michael Jai White, Gary Daniels, of course.
Dolph Lundgren.
Dolph Lundgren. Actually, I would like to work with Dolph Lundgren on a movie that he directs. I don't think there would be a good enough scenario to where it would make sense to where someone of his size and stature would be hanging out with someone like me on a movie. You know what I mean? Like, if they would share the screen together. I can't think of a way to where that would make sense.
Business at a bar and you come on in wanting room service.
I guess. I don't know. But I think I would enjoy the experience more of working with Dolph Lundgren if I worked with him, if he was directing, like if he was fully behind the camera.
He's done it four times. And I was in front. Let's hope it continues.
Yeah, but Dolph Lundgren's on the list. I would love, love, love to work with some of the international stars like Tony Jaa, Iko Uwais. There's this one guy, there's two guys in India that I'm not sure a lot of people hear of that I would love to work with. Tiger Shroff, he's done the popular Baghi trilogy, and they're about to start working on Baghi 4. And Vidyut Jamwal, he did the Commando series in India. Those are two guys I would love to work with. But in terms of filmmaking on a low budget, one of the cheapest places to do an action movie is Thailand, and I will do an action movie in Thailand as the main actor before I die. I promise you that. I just don't know when it'll be. But that is on the bucket list, to star in an action movie that's filmed in Thailand.
Would you like to somehow convince Jeff Speakman to get out of retirement and just like make a cameo in your movie?
I would absolutely love that. If I felt like I had that kind of pool and I was able to walk into Jeff Speakman's dojo and be like, hey, I need you in this movie real quick. And he'd be like, yeah, sure, no problem. I would absolutely love that. However, in terms of the Hollywood and film industry, my company practically doesn't exist. I'm not on anybody's radar like that. But good. If I could get him to play a cameo as a karate teacher, at the very least, I would be ecstatic.
Okay, very cool. And the martial arts scene is always going to be big on home video releases, and now it's on streaming and the internet. Do you think there's any other stars who do actually want to come back? They just haven't had any decent script or people they want to work with?
Yeah, actually. And I've heard this directly from him because I actually was doing some sort of appearance, and I was at his panel. And I asked him if he's ever considered coming out of retirement. And he says he never officially retired. He just wasn't given any opportunities. And that is Lauren Avedon, who we know from No Retreat, No Surrender 2 and 3, and also King of Kickboxers, where he fought Billy Blanks. I would love to see him come back and make another movie. And
I would love Billy Blanks. Do you think he would pop up?
Honestly, as cool as it would be to work with Billy Blanks, in my humble opinion, in terms of a martial artist and an actor and a filmmaker, I think he is focused right now on doing his Taibo thing, and I think he's content with that. So I don't really see him making a comeback. You know what I mean?
Kind of like how Frank Zagarino owns like a home movie theater setup system and doesn't want anything to do with movies anymore.
Yeah, essentially. But I don't think it's because he doesn't like it or he didn't have a good time when he did it. It's just he's so immersed in the world of fitness and Taibo right now that he's content with that.
Okay, very cool. And Avedon's good mention. Richard Norton?
Richard Norton is more behind the scenes now, but I would love to work on a movie with him as, like, the stunt coordinator. Like, I have a couple dream teams. Like, if I had this in a movie, this movie would be popping. You know, like, if I had a movie that was directed by Isaac Florentine, the fights were choreographed by Tim Mann and were directed by Richard Norton, and I had Scott Adkins playing the other lead, that is a perfect movie in my opinion right there.
Yep. For sure.
And that's why Accident Man is on the top of my action movie list. It's not what I would call a martial arts film per se, but it has everything that a martial arts fan would want.
For sure, for sure. And more or less, what do you think the future is going to be? You know, now streaming's taking over. Do you think it's just, you know, places like Tubi are going to take your movie?
I think it, honestly, I see the good and the bad with streaming coming more and more prominent. One, it levels the playing field for independent filmmakers to compete with Hollywood features, especially a platform like Tubi. Because you take a platform like Tubi who has movies for free, but and you have an independent title that looks somewhat interesting. If you see it on the Walmart shelf for $10, you're like, well, I know nothing about any of these people. I don't want to spend my $10 on it. But then you go home later that night, you get on Tubi TV, you say that you see that same title, and you're like, well, it's free. It's free on Tubi. I'll go ahead and I'll give it a shot. So you're more apt to build your audience that way. And then if they watch that movie, they enjoy it, then they're more apt to go back to Walmart the next day and buy that movie.
Right.
So I think that streaming levels the playing field, but at the same time, with the fact that it is leveling the playing field, there it's become oversaturated with a bunch of garbage. Like, there's a bunch of movies that were shot on crappy cell phones. And, yeah, they're an hour and a half long, but, you know, if you don't have a script and if you don't have this or that, and, you know, if literally all you have is a camera, you don't have any production value behind it, it's garbage.
Yep.
And honestly, I find it funny that I see people who make these garbage films, and then they go on these different like platforms and stuff. Like, they'll be on YouTube reviewing these movies, and like, they'll be like, in the same sentence, they'll be like, this low budget action movie that just came out that stars Michael Jai White was garbage. But in the next sentence, they'll be like, but go support my movie that I shot on a Motorola Razor, and I spent $20 in a pack of gum trying
sandwiches,
to make.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're trying, and they're saying it's on Tubi TV. Go watch it. And now I have seen some movies. I'm not saying that all movies with that are bad, because I have seen a few of them that are good. I own a couple of them that I've bought straight from the filmmaker themselves that just grinded enough to where they were able to make the movies and make them happen. You know what I mean? And a lot of times, I won't buy a movie, like when I buy a movie directly from the filmmaker, which I've done a number of times. If I'm buying like a DVD directly from the person who made it, it's more or less the fact that I support the grind. I respect you because you know you don't have a traditional distributor, and you know that your movie is not going to make a huge difference in the world. But you're still out here hustling, trying to get your movie out there, and you're trying to make a nickel. I'll pay you $10 for your movie.
Right. As opposed to someone who's going around messing with the IMDb reviews or just instigating arguments online.
I'm not just that way with movies. Like, when I went to Los Angeles to film my Iron Fist video, I had a bunch of rappers that did that with their mixtape that would come up and be like, yo, I'm out here trying to grind. I'm out here trying to get a record deal. Here's a mixtape I made in my basement using GarageBand and Pro Tools. And I'm like, you know what? I respect the grind. Here's $5. Give me that mixtape.
Right. As opposed to, you know, over-marketing or, I mean, it used to be way worse than Facebook. I want to say maybe circa 2010 to like maybe 2015, there would be people who, I kid you not, were so narcissistic with each other, they would keep sharing the same photos or promotion like within hours apart. I'm like, so you know you're only supposed to promote yourself once a day, right? Just, or once a week.
Dude, I don't even think Like, I'm in the middle of trying to generate an audience for Double Cross, and I don't even think I promote myself once a day. I think I maybe once or twice a week.
There was a bunch of people. There were filmmakers who would do it, models who would do it, and I'd be like, I saw you an hour ago.
Yeah, I mean, it does get a little old, but I think it's a little bit better now, especially now that we have our little niche groups on Facebook, where if you want to promote yourself, that's what people want you to do. You know what I mean?
It's had time to evolve versus get oversaturated.
Exactly. People are starting to learn, you know, you don't have to let everyone know, because that's, in the grand scheme of things, that's, I would say, between 2006 to about 2015, social media was still really in its infancy. And that's when we got a lot of these people, you know, posting statuses on Facebook. I just took a bite of cereal, LOL, and didn't really know what to do. Like, even I still look back on some of my Facebook memories from 2013, and I'm like, wow, I was such a teenage girl.
Well, here's still evolving, because, I mean...
Exactly. Because, honestly, if I was standing next to high school me right now, I would punch myself in my face.
I'm the same way with college. I'd be like, you know, I wouldn't work with me.
but all is well. Like I said, basically my whole journey is I took chances. I mean, the martial arts was kind of a reward for doing good in school, but everything stems from me learning martial arts. You know, because without the martial arts, I wouldn't have found, basically you. If in a weird kind of ultimatum kind of way, Power Rangers influenced Skin Circuit. If you want to look at the grand scheme of things,
I think it inspired a lot of stunts, let alone martial arts. Without, regardless of anyone's connection to it, you know.
Exactly. But if you look at it and be like the TV show Power Rangers, and if I say yes, Power Rangers was an influence on Skin Circuit, people are going to look at me and be like, "How is that?" But then I go back and I explain the story. Power Rangers got me into martial arts. Martial arts, you know, Power Rangers got me into martial arts films, and then I started doing martial arts, and then I started wanting to do my own martial arts films. If I give them the Reader's Digest version of that, then they're like, okay, that makes sense.
Very cool.
But I'm very happy to... I'm happy with where my life is right now in terms of, you know, my personal life and my film career at this point. And I've said this a whole lot of times, and I still stand by it. I don't need to be famous. I don't need to have $10 million in the bank. But if I could take my company and make movies and make enough money with those movies to support my wife and kid, then I would be happy.
Okay, very cool.
And like, I don't need to, I mean, sure, it would be nice to be known on all corners of the earth, but at the same time, I like my privacy. And my wife is also very private. So I would be happy to stay on the indie level just for a sense of privacy. And like I said, I don't need to have millions of dollars in the bank, but if I had enough money in the bank to where I could support my wife and my kid, then I'd be happy.
Totally. And here's to forming that production company and making all these movies at your leisure, you know?
that's the plan. Do a little bit of a plug real quick. My production company is called TKO Productions. You can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/TKO Productions LLC. You can find me on Facebook and Twitter at TKO Prods LLC. That's PRODS Prods, TKO Prods LLC, because they wouldn't allow a long handle for that, so I had to shorten it. But you can find me on there. You can find me on YouTube. My personal YouTube is my YouTube is Braden White MA. You can find me on Facebook. My acting Facebook page is Braden White, actor, martial artist. My personal Instagram is Braden White MA. My personal Twitter is Braden White MA. And with TKO Productions, basically what we are trying to do is show people that you do not need tens of thousands of dollars to make action movies. We're taking the resources that we have available to us, spending as little as possible, and we're making action movies. My first film was my short film, Skin Circuit. I think I paid a total of like $600 altogether for that, and it came out quite nicely. I'm on track for only spending a couple grand for Double Cross, and most of that is going towards food. And then later on down the slate, yes, a lot of people will work for free. No one will work for no food.
Yep.
But after that, we plan on starting pre-production on the feature version of Skin Circuit. And then we have a couple other projects down the line. A couple of them are inspired. There's a lot of my movies that I have that if you sat down and watched about three different movies, you'd be able to see. Like, a lot of my movies are like a compilation of like three other movies.
Nothing wrong with that. Whatever inspires
you. And so, so we have a couple of those. I have one that's a little bit further down the pipeline. When I say a little bit further, I'm talking probably in the next 2 years or so. It dives into the sci-fi a little bit. And then I have one that I'm still shopping around to my business partners to see if it's going to be feasible. By business partners being my wife, because she's co-owner of the business, and my best friend from high school. It's post-apocalyptic, and it's an idea that based off of a short story I wrote whenever I was in the 9th grade, and the idea just hit me the other day. I'm like, yo, this would be a great movie. And so I'm still talking about that one to see if, one, if it's physically possible to do it, and to see if it's going to be monetarily feasible to do it. But we have a slate of, I would say, about 9 films that I'm not going to say that are in active pre-production, but we have a list of 9 films that we have to choose from if we want to. And that list is continuously growing depending on who has an idea and what we're doing at the moment.
Either way, you're serious about them, so they will happen.
Yes. And like I said, I have my feature for Skin Circuit. The script is done for that one. I'm currently working on 2 more scripts. So I have 2 films that are in active pre-production right now. Well, let me rephrase that. I have 1 film that is getting ready to start production. Skin Circuit, the feature, I would say, is getting ready to start active pre-production. And I have 2 more films in the writing phase. So the next, I would say, 4 years or so are going to be pretty busy here at TKO Productions.
Nothing can stop the passion.
And that's literally what I do it for at this moment. If I make some money to support my family, then that's great. But I'm doing this right now because I genuinely love to do it.
We'll return after these messages.
Hey, feeling down? Feeling low? Not enough podcasts about movies in your life? Why not try?
They must be destroyed on sight!
The new podcast cure-all, sure to get you right with the world and on a path to better living. We have exploitation, we have Italian horror, we have zombies, we have slashers, we have crime films, we have spaghetti westerns, we even have sci-fi and sex comedies. So take a dose of
They Must Be Destroyed on Sight
as needed, and let the hosts Lee Russell, Daniel Harper, Paul Romali, and the odd guest host cure what ails you.
Warning, may cause atrophy, African consumption, black fever, bone shave, chin cough, colic, cramp colic, dropsy of the brain, elephantitis, grocer's itch, jaundice, mania, miasma, mortification, palsy, Pott's disease, rheumatism, scurvy, St. Anthony's fire, summer complaint, and worm fit in some people. Consult a physician before listening.
Did you ever see a film at such a young age it left you traumatized with cinematic wounds?
Necrophilia.
It's a dead issue, man. Don't push it. Cinema Psyops is a weekly podcast documenting an ongoing experiment on the mind of an unwilling test subject.
No one should have to watch this movie.
Oh, no one should have to watch this?
No one should have to watch this movie.
Surprisingly, it's not a topic that a lot of people really want to tackle.
I'm shocked, prudes.
I know, really.
Right?
It's the next sexual frontier that no one wants to explore.
I am, in the most sincerest of senses, disappointed in you.
It takes a powerful goddess like Connie, jam her arm down the monster's throat and kill it. Oh, I'm still tripping out over that. Even as a kid, I was like, I gotta find a girl like that.
Every week, I get a new look of disappointment that I never thought I could get out of
it. Unimaginable. At 12 years old, you should not be watching this movie.
Obviously.
At 13, you should not be. 14, you shouldn't be. I'm not entirely sure even 17-year-olds should be watching this movie.
Just because you're offended by something doesn't mean that you have the right to demand that it doesn't exist.
Watching this film again, I had all of this like little nerd glee with everything that kept
popping up. Little history doll popping up at you.
So I totally loved this film.
Hey, I know why you know, couldn't see that. It's because your brain's warped watching this shit at 12 years old.
Yeah, this is a rough movie. I told you ahead of time when we were getting ready to do it that it was going to be a rough
movie. How did you watch this shit at 12?
Because physical wounds heal, cinematic ones don't. Listen to Cinema Psyops.
Hey everybody, I'm Corey.
And I'm Zach. And we're the hosts of Podcasting After Dark, a cast dedicated to late-night horror and sci-fi of the 80s and 90s, often found on HBO and Cinemax.
You know, the movies your parents didn't want you watching as a kid. You can find us every other week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, and Stitcher.
This is what you want.
This is what you get.
It's time, let's check our cue, baby. Pair it with a couple brews, baby. We love good movies. We love the bad ones too. So we watch them all and pass their lessons on to you. Oh yeah.
Bana 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 out. Bana 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 out.
Everything I learned from movies helps to make life a little bit groovy. With a one-liner plot holes and gratuitous movies, it's time to get busy with your friend Steven Izzy
at EILFM.podbean.com.
We now continue with our program.
Follow us on the web on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The podcast is available on Podbean, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Anchor, Apple, and anywhere else podcasts are available. Feel free to review our show and leave comments on any of those sites. Thanks a million for listening.
It's a jacked up.